It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Trump administration is moving forward with plans to dismantle a prominent weather research center in Boulder, Colorado, with ties to Wisconsin.
The National Center for Atmospheric Research is a research hub for universities across the country, including UW-Madison and UW-Milwaukee.
Without the center's collaboration, researchers say their work could become more challenging.
Ankor Desai is a Vilas Distinguished Achievement Professor at UW-Madison and Chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Ankor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob and Kay, for having me today.
Ankor, can you tell us a little bit about what the National Center for Atmospheric Research does? What kind of work is happening there?
Absolutely. So the National Center for Atmospheric Research, which is a federally funded research and development center, has for the last 60 years led the country and the globe in bringing together the weather atmospheric sciences community and the climate community and the people who study all of the impacts from weather and climate extremes and hazards to work together to do the kind of research that any one university or any one researcher can't do themselves. This is a body that's governed by about 120 universities together that all have departments or centers that study atmospheric sciences. It is funded primarily through the federal government, through the National Science Foundation.
This is in Colorado. What's the Wisconsin connection? What kind of work are Wisconsin researchers doing with this center?
The NCAR has been part of almost every study that has come out of work in our department. One of the things that we learned as we started to reach out to colleagues across the campus last week is just how widespread some of the research that NCAR does. Everything from studying the sun and the upper atmosphere with folks in astronomy and physics to understanding extreme weather and flooding events and extreme precipitation, which is something that has significantly affected Wisconsin with colleagues in civil engineering and in various departments dealing with water, folks working in sustainability and global environment and public health on issues of air quality, the types of facilities, including the computing infrastructure, the aircraft and towers and other types of instrumentation, as well as the 800-plus employees who work at the NCAR Boulder facilities who provide the expertise and collaboration that make all of us much more powerful than any one individual group can do.
One of the reasons cited by the Trump administration was they say that the NCAR, the National Center for Atmospheric Research, brings us climate alarmism. In effect, quote, this facility is one of the largest sources of climate alarmism in the country. That's Russell Vaught, director of the White House Office of Management and Budget. Do you see it that way?
The White House has been using that language over the last year as part of a larger scale effort to dismantle what it views as science that's inconvenient to their aims. I would say there is no science that is done by NCAR or other researchers that is alarmist. For sure, some of the results are alarming, right? And they have important implications for how we plan for the future, how we manage future risks to everything from our agriculture to our water resources to our energy resources, from things like flooding, drought, and fire. Climate change is real and it is happening. And it's important to note that NCAR is not a climate center. It is an atmospheric and oceanic sciences center that studies weather and climate. You can't study one without the other.
The administration has also suggested that, hey, some of the key elements of what's going on there can just be transferred to other research centers. We won't lose the important stuff. Do you think that's true?
I think there's a role for always reconsidering how centers are operated and function, but I think that is fundamentally the role of the units that have the most expertise in governance, which is the University Corporation for Atmospheric Research, which oversees NCAR, of which UW-Madison is a founding member. I think that splitting up, say, for example, what the National Science Foundation has brought up is moving the research aircraft, as well as some of the supercomputing that NCAR is world famous for, into other centers or units is a little bit of a red herring. This is not some attempt to make this center more efficient or to make the science more effective. This is really an effect to dismantle a very effective institution that does its best work by working together. In my own research, where I try to study how Wisconsin landscapes influence weather and climate, I rely on the computing and the measurement infrastructure and the people all working together to contribute to the types of research we do in our lab.
We're talking about federal efforts to dismantle a major federally funded atmospheric science center with Ankur Desai, UW-Madison Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences Chair. UW-Madison and UW-Milwaukee both participate in research at that center, which is based in Colorado. On the weather side of things now, do we lose the ability to predict the weather, to understand what's going to cause and change the weather in coming days without some of the research that's going on at the center?
For sure, Rob. Not today and not tomorrow, which we're good at forecasting. But what NCAR does is it does the fundamental basic research that allows us to advance the types of weather models that are operated out of organizations like NOAA, which is also under attack, to make the types of forecasts that all of us have really gotten to rely on and that have gotten dramatically better over the last 50 years, primarily because of the research coming out of centers like NCAR. The models, the weather models that we use for these are all have their heritage at NCAR. In fact, some of the major models like the weather research and forecasting model were developed at NCAR and they are open source. Rob, you could go today and download that model on your own laptop and run your own personal weather forecast for free because this is all funded through the federal government through institutions like NCAR. And that is how a lot of our own students often get into this field and learn how to become future atmospheric scientists because they have access to all these resources that are provided by NCAR and other institutions to be able to learn and study themselves how to improve weather forecasts, how to improve our understanding of climate and climate change, and how to make that useful for society.
One of the big questions in climate change research is, okay, how does this global trend affect a local area? So what kind of things are going on with research on how is climate change affecting Wisconsin? That involves NCAR. You touched on your own research briefly on Wisconsin's landscape and its impact on climate and weather.
Yeah, let me give you another example as well as from my own research as well as some colleagues. But one of the things that NCAR is really good at is bringing very next generation measurements of things like precipitation and clouds through things like radar and other instruments to improve models that we make. One of the challenges of global climate change modeling is that to be able to do this on a computer that's fast enough and to get results that are reliable enough frequently requires some really heavy horsepower. NCAR Supercomputing Center in Wyoming is one of the few places in the world we can do that. But if we really want to understand what's happening at the local scale, we need to be able to take those models and also run models that are at a much finer resolution with much more local data. A lot of the efforts right now in that are through things like artificial intelligence and machine learning, through regional modeling, through what's called subseasonal to decadal prediction. And those are all areas that NCAR has had centers and groups that have been working on, and people in my own department, several of our faculty have been leading some of the efforts there as well. In my own work in northern Wisconsin, we ran a major field campaign that was heavily supported by NCAR in 2019 to study how the forests and wetlands and lakes that make up the North Woods influence weather and climate patterns. And we used measurements brought out by NCAR, 20 plus towers, along with dozens of undergraduate and graduate students, many who were trained by NCAR staff to build and deploy those towers, as well as fly on the aircraft they provided to make those measurements we need to improve that kind of fine scale resolution modeling I was just talking about, Rob.
NCAR isn't the only federal funding for atmospheric research that's in question now. Cuts to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, talk of retiring some satellites that monitor, among other things, the impact and progress of climate change. On a wider scale, what are your concerns about the future of this kind of research?
Rob, it's been a rough year for us in the atmospheric and oceanic sciences, for sure. Since January 25, we have seen full-scale assault on the type of work we've been doing at NOAA, at NASA, at the Department of Energy, and other institutes that take all of this information, some of the research that we conduct at universities, and make them useful for everything from hurricane forecasts and tracking to emergency response to all of the important roles that government and industry play. Just to give you one example, of course, we've been hearing a lot about challenges with our aviation system. We know that one of the challenges of aviation is weather and weather extremes. NCAR itself developed one of the first what's called low-level wind shear alert systems, which is now in every airport worldwide. But basically, you know, think about if you've ever flown in a plane and landed and noticed a lot of really heavy turbulence. Sometimes those are caused by things called microbursts, which are these intense downdrafts of air that can kind of happen and are hard to predict. And these systems have basically allowed us to save significant numbers of lives. These are the kinds of things that are risked by kind of cutting the seed corn that is the basic research of weather and climate science. And then to have the significant departure of individuals at NOAA and NASA and the shifting of priorities away from studying our own planet puts all of this work at risk. And it puts a challenge in how our field continues as we are struggling to continue our funding to be able to recruit the best students. We are struggling with immigration restrictions that allow us to recruit globally the best people in the world. And these are all things that are right now we're working hard to figure out how to work through and work forward and to make raise awareness. I'm glad that Congress has also been responding this week to the cuts to NCAR as well. And we're hoping that some of this will be turned around through the next years, but it may take decades to rebuild some of this.
Encore, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Ankur Desai, Vilas Distinguished Achievement Professor at UW-Madison and Chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, been talking about federal efforts to dismantle a National Climate Research Center and the future of climate science. We have a new year coming up, and maybe you have some new questions we can tackle here on the show. Maybe about research that's going on here in Wisconsin, or maybe you're doing that research and want to share it. Either way, let us know. You can email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Again, that address, wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, churches are stepping up to help people who are struggling. Hear from Wisconsin faith leaders about the growing community needs they're seeing.
It's been taxing. It's been exhausting because now it's not just a hungry person or someone that needs a bed for the night, but now there's a whole layer of fear.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's been a busy year for churches in Wisconsin with changes to food assistance benefits, rising health care costs, and a federal crackdown on illegal immigration.
Faith communities report growing calls for help among the people they serve, and many are stepping up to meet local needs in new ways with food pantries, clothing closets, warming shelters, and community dinners.
But some faith leaders say even these increased efforts aren't enough to stem the tide of rising need.
Last week, we brought together a roundtable of Wisconsin faith leaders to reflect on how this year of political and economic change has affected their ministry work.
Reverend Matthew Sauer is pastor of the Manitowoc Cooperative Ministry. Reverend Dr. Charles Thompson is pastor at Trinity Lutheran Church in New London. And Reverend Brianna Ilene is the director of Ecumenical Innovation and Justice Initiatives at the Wisconsin Council of Churches. I started by asking Reverend Brianna what she is seeing from her bird's eye view of churches throughout the state.
I think a lot of people are trying to respond to what is happening at the federal level. How is that really impacting people on the ground in their day-to-day lives? Immigration is huge. Many of our churches are asking, how can we care for our immigrant neighbors who are really scared right now? But also hunger. When SNAP benefits were delayed, many churches saw this influx of hunger. They see these people who are really struggling financially. And then on the other end, too, many are seeing the desire to help and trying to figure out, okay, how do we do this with these new arising problems? How can we plug in and respond to what's happening in our communities?
Are there enough volunteers in churches to meet all the different demands for volunteerism?
Yes and no. I think on one hand, many churches are stepping up in new ways. They are excited to respond, to do something new, something different. And then on the other hand, many are stretched thin. Our churches are demographics are growing older. And when you've had a food pantry for years and years and years, and then all of a sudden you have a demand that is twice as high, they don't have the capacity to respond to that. So it's kind of this both yes and no, depending on the context.
Pastor Matt, as we've been talking here about, you know, the all of these various needs bubbling up with food and housing insecurity, the cost of healthcare going up, what are you seeing on the ground in Manitowoc?
Well, for the last 17 years, we've been doing a Wednesday night dinner, a free community dinner, that we typically serve around 150. We did see a huge bump a while ago that, was pushing over 200 for several weeks. Now it seems to be pulling back a little bit more. But you had asked about volunteers, and we're in a position where we have a great community network. So our volunteer base is much larger than our congregation base. So on any given night of our ministry, I'm seeing more volunteers than we might have on a Sunday sometimes.
Wow.
But we're also working with homelessness and running a warming shelter. We've seen those needs increase, not so much at the overnight part of the shelter, but just services during the day. People are friendly enough that they can find a couch sometimes, but they still need other services. So it's been taxing. It's been exhausting because now it's not just a hungry person or someone that needs a bed for the night, but now there's a whole layer of fear and hopelessness. Like, we're never going to get out of this situation now. We're stuck here. And so there's this, the people seem more resolved to accept the brokenness of the system.
Turning to you, Pastor Chuck, can you tell us a bit about your congregation in New London and the food ministry you've been doing in the community?
This is a very resilient congregation. They've been through a flood, a tornado. There was a major split back in 2009, a very resilient bunch. But back in 2009, they were doing a stewardship program through the Synod. The Synod had recommendations about how to reach out to the community. And some of our leaders just talked to people in New London, like Clintonville area, and discovered hunger was a real need. So they originally, 2019, came up the idea, why don't we try to serve two meals a month, a year, that is. But then pandemic hit in early 2020. They came up with the idea, why don't we just try to serve people, they can just drive up. So we call it the grab-and-go meal. So the first one was in May of 2020, and the response was overwhelming. So they thought, gee, maybe we should do this more than twice a year. So then they decided to do it every month, you know, through October. It has grown steadily since. It's gone up 75%, the number of meals we've served since 2021.
Wow.
We started out with serving 136 meals on average, and now we're serving 239 in 2025. So the need has greatly gone up, as you can see, including 15% since last year. So it continues to go up. And so this ministry kind of makes us a little bit unique in the community. There's a lot of churches in New London. Each one does different things. But so this is kind of our part of our identity, I guess, the grab-and-go meals, it's called.
And you greet people who come through to pick up the grab-and-go meals at the church. What kind of stories do you hear?
Yeah, I'm the greeter when cars drive up and they wait in line. It's mostly elderly that we're getting, and many of them live on fixed income, and the cost of living is just going up and up. And they're not keeping up with that. And many of them have medical issues. And due to the healthcare crisis. You know, healthcare is a lot more expensive, so they have less and less money for food. And so at least, you know, once a month we're serving. And we do the last Wednesday of every month, so at least we can help a little bit with that.
I want to turn back to you, Reverend Brianna Ilene. I mean, you know, we're hearing really powerful stories of churches all over the state stepping up to help with the social safety net gaps that they're seeing in communities. And you've been reflecting, I know, on mutual aid and finding resources from within the community and exchanging them for free. What are you noticing with mutual aid?
Well, one of the things, even more broadly, is just the breakdown of institutions we've been seeing that is causing this need for mutual aid. Earlier this month, when SNAP benefits were delayed, I heard stories of churches who were ready to step up. They had the money, they had the volunteers, they were ready to go, but then they tried to tap into some of the more traditional sources of food through some of our major food banks and food programs that and found that these programs couldn't keep up because they didn't have the staffing or the trucks or the ability to actually source the food. And so it gets down to how do we kind of reach in the margins then? And mutual aid is one of the ways that's a little more informal that allows people to meet needs in our community. And so we have been seeing more and more churches popping up with like they call them little free food pantries or little blessing boxes, which is just a block or a box on the corner, kind of like a little free library. But instead, it's got food in it and anyone can drop off and anyone can take. And there's no restrictions. And there's even been expanded in Madison and now in Milwaukee, they're doing community fridges.
Yes,
so
yes.
So a whole fridge that is set up and people can just come, again, drop off extra food or get or take what they need. And this is really, I think, huge, especially for people who maybe can't make it to a pantry on time, people who can't, don't feel safe. Many of our immigrant neighbors, if you can just kind of come even in the middle of the night, grab some food and go, that's a huge way to meet this need. And it's very community focused usually.
We are talking about how churches in Wisconsin are responding to this economic and political moment and with all the year's changes to things like food benefits and healthcare costs and immigration enforcement. And we have a Reverend Brianna Ilene with the Wisconsin Council of Churches, Pastor Matt Sauer with the Manitowoc Cooperative Ministry, and Pastor Charles Thompson from Trinity Lutheran Church in New London. Pastor Matt, you know, ICE did a raid in Manitowoc in late September, detaining 24 people. How has immigration enforcement affected your congregation and in the broader community?
That's a great question. So personally, I live barely a mile from where the raid actually took place. It was really a park and ride at the Walmart where folks were just getting their carpooling to work where that took place. So, I mean, it's literally in my backyard. You know, it's about 3 miles from the congregation. So we're affected by it on so many different levels. In the congregation, I think that Sunday following, it was just, there was a little bit of shock and awe. You know, we'd read about these things, of course, but, you know, it's different when it's suddenly in your backyard, in your front yard. So there was a lot of fear, a lot of connections we have with the immigrant communities that live around us. I mean, Manitowoc County is the number one dairy producer in the state. And, you know, a huge percentage of dairy workers are immigrants. And so there were people who were uncomfortable coming to church regardless of their status. There was concern that because of we've had been outspoken about this issue and other issues that was anyone going to be safe or was our worship time going to be disrupted? We are very conscious of that we have people worshiping with us that may be on ICE's radar. So we will have folks go out and just check the parking lot to see, do we know the vehicles that are there or does there seem to be some unknown vehicles there. We have, you know, kind of a plan that, well, what if we just extended the service? What, you know, what would it mean to sing some more hymns, to offer some more prayers? I mean, we realize that technically now that being in worship, it doesn't have to stop somebody. But we're also aware that sometimes the image of raiding a church actively while it's worshiping can also be, you know, turn off. So, you know, so we have some contingencies in place. We've reviewed the site plan of the building that if some people needed to just be in different parts of the building, where are the least conspicuous parts of the building? Mm. You know, where are the different exits on the building? And we do that out of safety for everyone, but also out of compassion, simply because I don't want anyone that comes to worship to be afraid to either come or to leave that building.
Reverend Brianna, I'm wondering, in this moment of more federal immigration crackdown at the Wisconsin Council of Churches, what are you thinking and doing in this moment? And what are you hearing from churches you work with about their concerns?
We are hearing a lot of questions, a lot of people who are wondering how they can help. They see what's happening on the news and wondering what that looks like in their community. And we're also really cognizant that what's happening in larger cities like Chicago or LA or Charlotte is a different context than most of Wisconsin. We've got Milwaukee and maybe Madison, but when you've got these smaller communities, what does it look like to care for our immigrant neighbors there? And so we've just been lifting up a lot of guidance. We've worked with various legal teams to say, this is what kind of you are allowed to do and you aren't allowed to do. Here's some lines. How do you know what your rights are? So we've hosted Know Your Rights trainings for congregations and providing that support. And one of the things I do want to lift up too is I think there's this image sometimes of, oh, immigrant, or, and Matt talked about so many of our immigrants who keep our, like our farms working and restaurants and all these spaces. We also have a lot of immigrant pastors in Wisconsin. Hmm. Several of our member denominations have large number of immigrant congregations and immigrant pastors. And so many of them are sitting with this concern to say, well, what happens if all of a sudden we go for an immigration check-in and we are taken away? What happens if we are told to leave the country? What happens to our congregation and these people that we're loving and serving? And all of a sudden they're left without a spiritual leader. And so I think there's just a lot of fear in our communities. And then also just a lot of people asking, what can we do? How do we love? God calls us to love. There are so many scriptures in the Bible about welcoming the stranger, welcoming the immigrant. And so what does it mean to do that? And how do we do that? Whether it be through mutual aid and making sure immigrant family has groceries because they don't feel safe to go to the store, all the way up through going to the Capitol and working on advocacy and seeing if there's legislation we can pass to try to create some more safety in our state.
Pastor Chuck, in New London, when you hear those words, God calls us to love, what is coming up for you?
The two greatest commandments, love God and love your neighbor as yourself. And who was our neighbor? Everybody. And so we are seeing a lot of hurting neighbors, especially, you know, with hunger. And that's specifically what we've been trying to help with here in New London. So, yeah, basically, that's it. These are our neighbors, our friends, family, whatever. So that's what comes to my mind. Mm.
Pastor Matt, you know, this is also a time of year when there are so many demands on churches, but that there are so many demands on pastors as well. Do you feel your faith gives you additional resources into helping all of these needs, all of these communities around you? How do you persevere?
You know, there's an old saying that preachers ought to preach to themselves before they're preaching to the congregation. Mm. And, you know, I've been recognizing that more and more, that so often the preparation of sermon and Bible study and things like that, I need to hear those words too. I need hope, because in my life, I've been pastoring congregations now for 30 years. And I feel more need for hope now than ever. And so it's not only a community, but I recognize that myself. So I'm drawing on this vision, this ancient vision, and this Advent season is a great to talk about the words of the prophet who are putting forth this vision of this is what God's world looks like. Why are we not there? You know, and letting people connect those dots. But I think now more than ever, the human relationships are important, and we've got to build that one-on-one. And so my work has gotten more and more out of the office and more, you know, quote unquote, on the streets, you know, and trying to engage the people where they're at and to let them know that they are being seen. And, you know, love, like we said, but love, one of the ways that we express love is through justice. So the resources that I hope I'm bringing to the community, to my own family, is this idea of hope, that there is not just the possibility that things may get better someday, but that things will be better someday. And that's the hope we have to hold out, that each one of us does our part to love our neighbor through loving justice.
Well, Pastor Matt and Pastor Chuck, Reverend Brianna, thank you all so much for sharing in this conversation.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It was a pleasure.
That was Reverend Brianna Ilene with the Wisconsin Council of Churches, Pastor Matthew Sauer with the Manitowoc Cooperative Ministry, and Pastor Charles Thompson from Trinity Lutheran Church in New London. They joined us to talk about how their ministry work has changed this year to meet increased community needs, with the rising cost of food and healthcare and the uptick in immigration enforcement.
Coming up, it's the story of Lightning and Thunder, the Neil Diamond tribute band from Milwaukee. The new film Song Sung Blue is set to open in theaters nationwide. Hear from the singer who the movie's based on.
I am humbled, and I love the fact that the story is getting out.
That's coming up next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. The movie about Milwaukee's legendary Neil Diamond tribute band, Lightning and Thunder, is set to open Christmas Day in theaters.
It's called Song Sung Blue. It follows the real-life story of Claire and Mike Sardina from Wisconsin, who fell in love and found success on stage with Neil Diamond's music.
The two performed together from 1989 until Mike's death in 2006. They played venues like the Wisconsin State Fair and Summerfest, opening for Pearl Jam and performing with lead singer Eddie Vedder.
Based on a 2008 documentary of the same name, the film stars Kate Hudson alongside Hugh Jackman. Jackman calls the movie a love letter to Milwaukee.
Producer Beatrice Lawrence attended the Milwaukee premiere of the movie earlier this month. It drew together friends and family of Claire and Mike Sardina. Star Hugh Jackman was also there. Here's a listen.
The food, the people, just the feeling here today. We went to some schools. The feeling in this city, there's something special about it, and I sort of knew that because of doing this movie. And being here tonight is in many ways the most important night for this movie. Being here with the family, whose lives we're portraying. I don't know. I've absolutely loved it. The cold has surprised me a little bit. I may not have been fully prepared. I think it's a movie about all of us, no matter what. And it makes me, every time I see it, I walk out in the street and I want to know what's going on in everyone's life. Because there's no such thing as just normal, everyday lives. Every life is extraordinary.
The film's director, Craig Brewer, was at the Milwaukee premiere. Beatrice asked him about the first time he learned about Lightning and Thunder.
Well, kind of like all the stories that that intrigue you. Like, I thought it was just going to be fun. I saw it at a film festival, and I was like, oh, well, this is just going to be a fun little thing that I'm going to see, like some band, you know, doing Neil Diamond songs. And then this story just, like, started unfolding, and I was just captivated with it. It was just incredible. It really was. When it comes to, like, stories about just, like, people that are, like, struggling, but they really also ultimately want to be artists, that's what really got me. It's like they wanted to just perform and also like be very committed to each other and committed to their community, and that's really the kind of movies that I've always really been, you know, inspired by.
Claire Sardina joins us now to talk about her memories of performing with her late husband Mike and how it feels to see her story told on the big screen. Claire, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
This movie had a big premiere playing to a packed theater. It'll be in theaters nationwide opening on Christmas. How does it feel to see this deeply personal part of your life represented on the big screen?
Well, it's emotional. I'm elated. I am humbled. And I love the fact that the story is getting out and nationwide, not only nationwide, but worldwide, and being recognized by people such as Oprah Winfrey and Howard Stern and Reba McEntire, things like that, yes.
What do you think, Mike, would make of this moment and the crowds coming to see a movie about your story?
I think he, too, would be elated, and I believe in my heart of hearts that he is. He watches over me. He guides me. I look up to the heavens when I feel somewhat overwhelmed by all the hype, and he brings me back to the level of the performer that he taught me to be. So he himself would have been, it would have been a dream for him, and it is a dream come true.
You say that he taught you to be a performer. What skills did he pass on to you that you keep with you today?
Just the overall entertainer in him. He showed me how to be a true entertainer, number one, you know, to not be fazed by things that were happening outside, but feel the stage in 100% every aspect and be there for the people. He taught me that because he was such a people person himself. And entertainers, in my opinion, should be that way anyway. They shouldn't be performing for themselves. They should be performing for their audiences, whether they're big or small. So he taught me those things. He taught me vocal skills, how to sing, like just by listening to him, not necessarily taught me. And, you know, we did, sometimes we were cute and did vocal exercises prior to, but both of us practice our craft as far as our tributes were concerned. And again, he was an interpreter of the great Neil Diamond. He didn't call himself an impersonator, which was good. It was great because he wanted to do the music of the great Neil Diamond for people to love and enjoy. And what I've heard is that, you know, I heard Hugh Jackman say on one of his interviews, we believe that if it wasn't for Mike, this whole thing wouldn't be happening because Mike was a dreamer, and we feel the music, the movie has really, because of Mike, this is why this movie is taking place. And I agree with that. I mean, I was his counterpart, the love of his life. And again, he was a teacher to me, a father to my children, so many things. He would be thrilled.
I'm wondering, out of all the legendary musicians who are out there to be singing tribute to, why Neil Diamond? Why did the two of you channel Neil Diamond?
Well, we got advice from an Elvis impersonator at the time, and he stopped Lightning and said, and Lightning had dabbled a little bit with a couple of Neil Diamond songs, and he stopped him and said, you know what? This is something you need to pursue. And Lightning listened to him, and then he got the hairstyle, you know, he's got the dark hair, and he took on kind of the persona of Neil, but his own persona too, because again, his claim to fame was, I am not a Neil Diamond impersonator. I am an interpreter of the music of the great Neil Diamond. It's my honor and pleasure to sing the music of the great Neil Diamond. And he learned many, many of the classics and all the popular Neil Diamond songs and put it together in about a 45 to 50 minute set of a tribute that attracted audiences everywhere.
You took on Patsy Cline, who was such a trailblazer for women at the time, you know, really pioneering a way for women to be lead singers. And she never fully realized her country music stardom, you know, dying tragically in early death in a plane crash.
Why?
What did you see in Patsy Cline as an artist?
Well, what I saw was, I loved her country twang. I loved her, you know, I loved her stage presence with the videos that I watched. And I loved the meaning of her songs. The meaning of her songs, you know. I fall to pieces. And of course, her all-time favorite hit of classic hit Crazy. And Sweet Dreams is featured in the movie Song Sung Blue. I love that song. Walking After Midnight. I mean, her songs had strive and meaning to them. And the audiences just ate it up. And they would sing along with me. And I attracted a large senior audience, because the seniors, when they were younger, they experienced the late, great Patsy Cline before she perished in the plane crash.
Claire Sardina is with us talking about the memories from her legendary Neil Diamond tribute band, Lightning and Thunder. She shared the stage with her late husband, Mike Sardina, and their life is the subject of a new film called Song Sung Blue. Claire, at the height of your popularity in Milwaukee, you were in an accident. The car hits you while you're outside your home. You end up losing your foot. How did that affect you and Mike as musicians and as a couple?
Well, I was, to be exact, gardening in my front yard. A car came up on my property and ran me over and took my leg. And of course, the impact was strong, as it would be to any other family and circumstance. You know, no matter what their circumstance is, it rocked our world. And for a while, we thought we weren't going to be able to get up and go again. You know, my feelings of insecurity, my mental health went downhill. The pharmaceuticals that they put me on because of my operations were strong, and I had had several operations. And Lightning was alive during all but one of my operations that I had. So it impacted the whole family. But yes, it put a monkey wrench, as I quote from the movie, in all aspects of our life, even the performance aspect. So it took a while to get back on our feet, no pun.
I wonder how singing affected your recovery and your ability to heal.
Oh, well, that's easy. Music is a universal healing power to it. Music, singing. I've got a God-given gift that I like to share with people. Ever since I was 3 years old, I was singing. I wasn't going to let this hold me back. It took me a while to bounce back after the loss of Lightning, which happened after the accident, of course, you know, in Concession. So I had time where I hermitized myself, reflected, looked into myself. I ended up quit smoking. I had a major operation that I was actually in a wheelchair for 9 months, but it pivoted me to now being able to dance and sing. And I still, of course, do perform.
What can we learn from your life story, even if we're not musicians who go on stage?
What you can learn is attitude is everything. You know, there's a way, the truth and the light of everything that is real. Now, I mean, I'd say to people across the board, if you look at others that are less fortunate than you are, put yourself in their position and you won't feel so sorry for yourself, because others, there are others out there that have far greater disabilities or just life problems or cancer victims for that matter. Everybody's got a health story to tell. And it's all in the attitude. And this too shall pass, as Lightning would say. That was one of his favorites. I think it comes from AA as an expression. And that's what I would tell people to do. Be positive, and this too shall pass. You can do this. You can do this. You just don't sit in the chair and feel sorry for yourself and wither and waste away. Get up, do something, do your stretches, do your rehab, listen to your doctors, have surgery, have what it takes to become a whole person again, and pray. I pray a lot, too.
Claire, thank you for sharing your story and your inspirational words. Appreciate it.
Yes, no problem.
That is Claire Sardina. She shared the stage with her late husband, Mike Sardina, as Lightning and Thunder, a Neil Diamond tribute band that performed around Milwaukee from 1989 until 2006. Their life is the subject of a new film starring Hugh Jackman and Kate Hudson called Song Sung Blue. It comes out this week. This is Lightning and Thunder performing Neil Diamond's Forever in Blue Jeans with Pearl Jam's Eddie Vedder at Summerfest in 1995.
We just heard the story of Wisconsin's own Lightning and Thunder, the movie about them and their career as a tribute band.
And we want to know, have you ever been a fan of a tribute band, or have you seen a great performance by one?
Maybe it's a particularly awesome Elvis impersonator, a tribute act devoted to your favorite performer, or maybe a cover band that brings a lot of different acts to life.
Pay tribute to your favorite tribute act. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch. That number is 888-642-0232. Once again, that's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Royce Podeswa, Rochelle Wilson, and Beatrice Lawrence.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for listening to WPR News.